Station number 16718, Major Wilfred White, Reel 17.
Mr. White, Reel 17. You were talking about the sick soldier, Mr. White.
Yes, the our task was, of course, to help the doctor get the lad. I think he's called Private Bernardo, that sort of name. Later we found out he's the father of six or seven sons, you know. But our job was to get him to the hospital. There was a signal box on the line that runs into Parma, where obviously there's going to be a hospital. And by the use of a cart, and straw, and a horse, we loaded the lad on, and that pulled him away. We accompanied at a discreet distance, so we weren't part of the procession. And Dr. Jimmy was last seen by us talking to the Germans at the signal box. And he took him into hospital. And he, of course, went straight back into the bag. So, you know, it was a really typical gallant action of what you would, you know, of a doctor. He certainly saved a life there. And we did hear a bit later on that someone else who was on the loose line as we were had sight of Jimmy getting his patient onto the train and going off with the Germans. Unfortunately, we never made contact with him again. It was sort of one of the unfortunate things.
So now you're down to three.
Now we're into three. And we stayed as three, with, you know, the many adventures until we met this young lady who we thought was Italian but wasn't. She was English, Jillian, with a traveling companion, Douglas.
What were their surnames?
Oh dear. Well, Douglas was Douglas D. Chent. Oh golly. Well, it'll come. And she had married an Italian before the war started and to Italy. But he was a fascist, I gather, red hot. And immediately Italy declared war. He got his wife interned in some camp. And obviously that was the end of that, as far as he was concerned. But Jillian being Jillian, okay, alas, some spirit, she escaped and fell in with an Italian and his wife, who were doing some service to help the Allied prisoners. I believe they were smuggling wireless sets into the senior officers' camps, prisoner of war camps. This was one story I heard from Jillian. And Jillian joined in with them and was doing this sort of work when they were captured by the Germans. And I believe the two Italians were dealt with and shot. and Gillian got put in a hard labour camp, from which she escaped and met Douglas, the man who was traveling with her, and decided to make for the Allies together.
But he was army, was he, Douglas?
Yes, he was in the Kent Yeomanry. But again, you see, we joined forces, and Gillian, far from hindering, was a great help, especially when we needed to ask questions of directions and that sort of thing. And at round about this time of the trip, it was December, and we were travelling high up in the hills, which had the advantage of keeping out of the way of the Germans, because they were getting thicker and thicker on the ground. But they didn't do much travelling on the top of the mountain ranges, because they're pretty high. But of course there was no tracks, no tracks going the way we wanted to go, and we were dropping down into gorges and crossing water and then climbing up again, and we weren't making much mileage. But during the hours of daylight, for example, we had this magnificent view of the battlefield, which was in approximate terms in the Pescara region of Italy, and we could actually see the airplanes, our planes, strafing the German lines. We could see our artillery shelling the German lines, and we could see the Germans firing back. So that bit by bit, day by day, we built up a picture of the spots to avoid and the spots to go for, if you know what I mean. Because we didn't have any maps of the area,
This would be based on the amount of activity in a given area, was it?
Yes.
So you had it for the quieter ones or the...
Well, we knew that the first thing was that we knew where the German artillery line were. So we thought, well, if we go... We're talking within hundreds of yards, you know. If we go much nearer in that direction, we're going to have that gun position to deal with or to get out of the way. So we would avoid that sort of gun position, and then on that sort of basis feel our way forward. And we picked up our point on the skyline, which looked to be our guide point, because remember we would probably have to do this the last journey at night time.
Had you been travelling during the day?
During the day, yes. I believe we said we started travelling by night, but very quickly that became there was no need to. There was so much cover, and we were so far up out of the way that we were unlikely to run into them, really.
Before we go any further, can I ask you, had you come across any one or any situation which was dangerous for you? Was there anyone who you felt might give you away?
Well, we never had that feeling, and I certainly never had that feeling regarding the our Italian contacts. I was quite confident that...
Had you any very narrow escapes?
Well, at the time we thought we had, there was one or two occasions where we really did face up to the Germans, as it were. As ever, there's always a bit of humour in it, like the nearly died with fright when the German appeared, unslung his rifle, and handed it to me. He was a deserter. So we chased him off. He would have been a nonsense. Didn't want him. It was a different matter of fact as we got very close to the German lines and our lines, because we couldn't get our gifts of food from the Italians, because they'd been driven off their farmlands, and we saw a cow which was just about to die. The professional opinion of a zoologist, it was coughing its lungs up or something. So we sat in a ditch, certainly Ian and I. Jack was probably there, our third member. And it died. And two or three Italian farmers, who also were scrounging food for food themselves, nipped and started hacking it to pieces. And they gave us a lump of beef off the leg, I think. And very quickly, Ian and I were preparing a meal. Ian was, I remember, was cutting up the beef. He had a razor blade. And I was coaxing a fire to boil a pan of water. And the fire was going merrily. Ian was cutting away. And I looked up to gulp air before getting my face in the fire again. And there was a German. He really had got the drop on us both, walking towards us with his rifle pointing at us, and I said something to Ian, you know, to keep cutting, but look. And there he was. And fortunately, I think he must have been part here of a gang rustling sheep for the obvious reasons. Someone beyond the crest of the hill that he was descending shouted for him, and he turned and went back to join his mates. And of course Ian and I turned and we skedaddled, and unfortunately I left my sack, which had a little bit of food, but more important, had names of people that I'd been meeting. And well, it would have been useful, I think, to take that back. But that was as near as we wanted to be. We were getting on. We're getting weaker, because we were now sleeping out in the open at night. And it was very, very cold. Time of the year, it was about, you know, the December 20th sort of time. And talking things over, as we frequently did, we decided to target for December the 24th to be the night, thinking that they might be celebrating the advent of Christmas, perhaps. And certainly, if we were caught, to be a bit more Christian than they would be other nights. So that was the plan, to go on December the 24th. But on December the 23rd, we got ourselves in a position, still up on the mountains. We'd had a horrendous few nights, you know, and we hadn't had much food. We got ourselves in a position where we virtually, you know, we could almost point the way we had to go. And I think I mentioned that it's this sort of part of Gwadia Greli was the name of the village. In the mountains, the church which stood up clearly, and it would be our point on which we navigated. So I don't know who it was who said, let's go tonight. Never mind tomorrow night, December 24th. So we all agreed on that. And we said, you know, let's see what food we've got. And Ian, the crafty so-and-so, had been carrying a tin of, I don't know what it was, but a tin of meat. And somebody else had a bag of sort of haricot beans, you know, the things you soak for a week in water before you can do anything with them. So we had this big melange, and I think this tin of porridge was discovered. And, well, we had a celebratory feast. And when it got dark, we set off, and it was so dark that, as I've used the expression before, it's the sort of darkness you can feel. You could feel it sort of wrapping you up. And we were going along, and suddenly, well, I wasn't leading the party, but my foot slipped. I don't know what was beyond it, but I couldn't see, but it was a big hole. And, well, we'd all hit the same sort of thing at the same time. And we were obviously on a sort of an edge of a fairly precipitous drop. And we didn't know quite what to do. We went as far as we could downwards. But then we decided to wait until the moon came up, which it did. And that got us to the bottom of this sort of gorge or ravine. And then we started climbing up the other side of it. And it was all very clay, not rocky clay. You know, you sort of clagged onto it and making handfuls, pulling out handfuls to get a grip. Now, we didn't know how high we were going. We kept on climbing there, and this is, I think, where Gillian showed a spirit, you know, that she was in the thick of it, and far from being a handicap, was sort of cheering us on a bit. And we got to the top of that and down the other side and crossed a small stream, and then we plodged on through this sort of muddy sort of field, keeping our eye on the Gwadia Greli. We realized that our guns who were firing sounded as though they were behind us. In other words, we passed through them, and sat and we rested a little while, I remember, and I was dying for a smoke. And all I had, I'd been given some green tobacco by a farmer, and I had this money I told you, this camp money, and I used that to roll up a cigarette and had a smoke. Regretted it, mind, because they honoured the money when we got back to our chaps. And we saw these vehicles, jeeps, but they had a funny gun hitched on the back of them. So we were a bit cautious, and we just sort of wondering what to do, and the voice says, the usual, you know, halt, who's there or who goes there. We said, you know, don't shoot. we'd got back about 5 o'clock in the morning, and we're taken into the guard room. There were they were parachutists, our parachutists, a sort of a brigade of specially trained and equipped for the fighting in the mountains. And these had been the guns that we'd seen were sort of a howitzer piece. But
so you come through the German positions without realizing you were through them.
That's right. We had one scout going through when somebody thought they saw a patrol moving, so we stopped where we were. And they passed close to us, but there were...
Was this position still in the mountains, the lines?
Yes.
In that mountain area?
Yes, we were fringed. We sort of went round the fringe of it, not at the top of the mountains, but as high up as we could, but keeping sufficiently close to where the action was, because we had to navigate on it. In a way, and then there we were in the guard room. Of course, I don't know if you can imagine what a cup of tea's like that's been brewed from 7 o'clock the night before. You know, it was dreadful, and they gave me some English cigarettes, of course, and having been smoking the green tobacco for 3 weeks before. You know, they were terrible too, and I thought, well, blimey, because you accommodate to what you can get. So that was a disappointing. But
what was your initial feeling when you heard that English voice?
Terrified, in case you fired his gun. Yeah. Oh, don't shoot, for Christ's sake. Yeah. But oh, relief, really. No, the immediate reaction is that...
Were they obviously surprised to see you?
They were very surprised, because when we were debriefed, we had two debriefings, I seem to remember. The first one was with the brigade major, or I don't know the ranks in this sort of gunnery outfit. We marked his map of the German batteries, the German gun positions, and he was amazed that we'd found a way through without, you know, bumping into them. And do you know what he suggested? That we took him back and showed him the way we'd come. Well, that wasn't on, was it? I mean, we'd slipped through a hole in the net, but there's still a lot of places we could get snagged up. So we said, no, it wouldn't work that way. I mean, we'd walk blindly all night.
You'd have difficulty finding
it.
Well,
couldn't find it, as you see.
What kind of thing is a debriefing? What form does it take when they take you in?
Very much the way you debriefing me. Tell us a bit about the story, so, you know, introduce me to the story. Did you see what regiments there were and what the armaments were, and how many would you reckon is... We are noticing the enemy more and more as you're getting forward. But then he was, after precise information, is the dam at Pescara... Or on across the Pescara River, what sort of, how is that sort of protected? Did you see, you know, he's asking on specific
military
things. And, of course, we...
Did you have any documents that you'd been carrying with you that showed you who they were, or who you were, sorry?
No, well, I certainly didn't have. they had to accept that I was who I said I was. I had no wallet with the usual bits of paperwork. When you go into action, these sort of things you leave behind. At least we did. You know, I had no personal letters or photograph even.
What was the reaction of the people who you bumped into or came into towards the lady that you had with you?
Well, I think it was because Gillian joined us late in our trip. We were never introducing her to anyone. We were already in the land of the occupied territory, feeding off the land where we could. And rather than knocking on the door of the farmhouse and, you know, asking her if we could have a meal and stay the night or be accommodated for the night. So I think that's the answer.
And the British themselves, when you walked into the parachutist, did they treat her differently from yourselves?
Did they
treat her differently?
They most certainly did, of course, because, she was a striking young lady, and she was taken away, and we lost her for a day. The rest of that day, undoubtedly, she was, you know, having a bath and that sort of thing. And I think there was a French women's unit nearby, and they kitted her out with a nice skirt and blouse. And obviously she got well scrubbed and bathed and combed. And when she appeared on Christmas Day, as it were, in our base, home base, she looked very, very charming. And I'd been cuddling her the night before. It was my turn. We used to take turns, you know, to keep warm. And I thought, my God. We got about six invitations from the various units, because it was a place called a tesser, I think, and it was a sort of a base depot where there was the headquarters of the signalers and the headquarters of the Royal Engineers and the headquarters of this, that. It was that sort of garrison town, as it were, and got invitations right, left and centre, all because of Gillian, of course, you know. But we sorted it out, so we had four Christmas dinners that day.
Could you eat after having such a bad time? Did you find you were able to eat okay?
Oh, yes, I could eat. I probably did eat my boots, you know. Mind, when we got to our own mess, which I call is the mess we were taken to, first of all, an infantry mess, we fortunately, after the fourth helping of, we're starting eating Christmas dinners at about 9 o'clock in the morning, you know, the unit and we had one just before midday, 11 o'clock-ish, and another one at 2-ish, you know. When we were having our meal in the evening, thank God it was fruit and juice and not Christmas pudding, because it was just beginning to tell then.
Did they give you uniforms as soon as you met them?
Yes, because they were... We really were disgusting to look at, because in addition to the fact that the clothes were rubbish when we got them, you know, they were very well worn. We'd had them on for two or three months. We'd deloused ourselves once or twice, you know, horrendous sights. But then clawing up these hillsides in the clay and that, covered with the greyish slime. And indeed, we had to be deloused twice. We got our bath and it was marvellous and scrubbed and into uniform, and lo and behold, next day we're still, we hadn't got all the animals out. So I certainly had two goes.